Agenda 6785, 8 o'clock a.m., hearing room A. Public hearing and work session SB 274, SB 178, SB 347. Work session SB 275, SB 73, SB 179. House Bill 2043, HB 2053, HB 2231. This is tape 262, side A.
See, at least the first three items on our agenda will be a problem that Frank Bronner from the Oregon Bankers Association has recently discovered. And I'm not sure how recent, I don't know the time frames, but let's say discovered and brought to the attention of the committee. And it's my determination it's something that we should be interested in. And he has a presentation to make this morning. Second item on the agenda will be 2231. Third item, 2382, and then we'll see where we are at that point and make some determinations where to go from there. So to begin with this morning, Mr. Bronner, would you and your guest please come forward? Frank indicated that he would limit the testimony this morning to 8 minutes. Going to ask him to cut that in half and do it in four. And we have a very lengthy agenda. We still have about 10 House bills that we haven't gotten out, and today is presumably our deadline for House bills. And we're trying to avoid a Saturday meeting if at all possible, so if we could get through this pretty quickly. I'm convinced you have a problem. I'm convinced that we need to find a solution to the problem. So as we've been telling everybody, direct relationship between brevity and success.
I think I understand that, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chairperson, members of the committee, I'm Frank Bronner with the Oregon Bankers Association. I believe that you have LC-1 amendments to House Bill 2163 that have been prepared in response to the problem that we discovered 10 days, 2 weeks ago, which deals with...
Let me steal a bit of your time. This is my time.
We didn't really have the amendments in there because we didn't have that bill up. So that bill's not up, so all we have is a presentation this morning.
In fact, we had a 24-hour notice problem, so what we'll do is have the presentation, and if, in fact, the committee decides it wants to move forward, then we'll schedule a bill for first thing Monday and get it on its way.
Do you repeat the number?
2163. We're discussing individual retirement accounts, and as we all know, some of these operations are now self-directed. And there's been recent advances in the types of instruments used. With me is Lynn Evans, Senior Vice President, First Interstate Bank, who discovered the problem, has drafted the solution, and will speak to the proposal.
Chairperson, members of the committee, thank you for your time. I'm Lynn Evans, Senior Vice President of First Interstate Bank of Oregon. I head the bank's Investment and Funds Management Division. Here today on behalf of the Oregon Bankers Association Investment Committee. The purpose of this amendment is to clarify the state's tax treatment of distributions from individual retirement accounts and for retirement plans of self-employed individuals when those plans are invested in U.S. Treasury obligations. In the past, IRAs and other self-directed retirement plans have not been actively invested in Treasury obligations due primarily to the high minimum investment amount required. However, the recent introduction, actually in February of this year, of the Treasury separate trading of registered and interest of principal of securities, STRIPS, the acronym, has made available a high-yielding U.S. government-guaranteed investment with denominations as low as $1,000. In addition to the low minimum investment amount, the zero coupon securities have the advantages of eliminating the uncertainty and inconvenience of reinvesting coupon income and having a guaranteed value at maturity. Investment in STRIPS, the zero coupons, therefore has become very popular with individuals funding their IRAs and KEO plans. At the same time, however, the treatment of the state's tax treatment of IRA distributions where the plan assets consist of STRIPS or other government obligations is unclear. In a recent verbal statement, the state's revenue office asserted that distributions from an IRA plan are subject to state taxation, even where income is derived solely from U.S. government securities. That claim is disputed by attorneys, both within the our bank attorneys and outside counsel, and is directly at odds with a well-established principle that interest income on government securities is not subject to state taxation. Because there's no direct reference in the state revenue code to the tax treatment on U.S. government securities when held in a retirement account, an individual retirement account, or a KEO, the instrument is relatively new. It hasn't evolved to the point where litigation in the courts would resolve it. An amendment is necessary. Since income produced by individual direct holdings of government securities cannot be taxed by the state, it's inconsistent and potentially a source of litigation to tax those instruments when held in a self-directed or an individual retirement plan. This bill would resolve the inconsistency and removes a growing source of confusion by individuals investing for their retirement plans. Thank you for your time.
Questions? Representative Schoon.
Lynn, does it make a difference whether the interest is reinvested or not?
Chairperson, Representative, the instrument is one of a direct obligation of the Treasury is discounted from the face value, and much like a Series E bond or a Treasury bill, only longer term, accrues to maturity. So the method of interest payment really isn't the issue. It's the form in which the securities are held.
Aside from that, does it make any difference whether or not that discount is reinvested in the IRA or the KEO plan, or whether it's taken as individual income, in other words, as a distribution from the IRA?
No.
Okay. Further questions? I understand there's, Jim, is it an informal Attorney General's opinion that would essentially reverse, as I understand it, the Department of Revenue?
Well, no, there's not anything definite at this point.
Okay, nothing definite at this point. Yeah. There's some indications that the Attorney General might indicate that this is not taxable, Frank.
Mr. Chairperson, I think as Lynn said, the statute is silent, and of course it would be silent because we didn't have these things until February this year. There's a conflict. There's a conflict between IRA and direct investment, and it's our feeling that what you could take advantage of tax treatment wise on a direct investment, you individual, you ought to be able certainly to have that same benefit as you invest in your individual retirement account or KEO program.
My recommendation to the committee is that we draft amendments to make certain that this is not taxable and put a four-year sunset on it so we can have the opportunity to review it. There's changes obviously going on at both levels and give us the opportunity to make certain we have a review. Initially, we're talking about a two-year sunset, but four is probably sufficient. Further discussion?
Oh, just
that sound, Representative Burroughs?
We tried to deal, well, we made sure, if I remember, in 2011, that IRS and KEO interest was not taxed. That was part of 2011. So this, to me, is just following the thrust of 2011.
Representative Clory?
Well, I'm supportive of all that, except I wonder why we wouldn't just call the department up and ask them why they're causing such trouble.
Somebody from the department want to come up and respond very briefly? Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
I may have some questions.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Verlina Crosley from the Audit Division, Department of Revenue. We really aren't trying to cause trouble, Representative Clory. It is an unclear area, and I very much support getting it into legislation and have a firm policy. It's one of those areas that we've done research and have had in the past, asked informal opinions, but they've been different types of accounts than these strips. Each one of them are designed just a little bit differently, and to date, all of those have not been allowed the subtraction treatment, which means they would be taxable. This is just one other form, and it would appear that they are enough different that they may be allowed the non-taxable status, but we just aren't sure at this point. And so it would be better if it was addressed in legislation form. The other ones have been addressed in rule form.
Mr. Chairman. Chief Schoon.
Can you tell us in 2 sentences or less what a direct holding is?
No, Representative Schoon. Okay. They might be able to tell you better than that.
Representative Hostick? Oops. No. Oh, okay, there you are. Excuse me. Are there any further questions for Ms. Crosley?
I do have one more comment.
Okay.
The other plans that we've seen have not been self-directing like they referred to. Basically, they've been more in the form of mutual funds, where the fund actually holds it and it's not actually in the recipient's name. And these, as we understand them, they would be in the recipient's name. I have an IRA account myself and it's in my name, and then I just basically direct where it goes and what it's invested in. And that gives the person more control than the other ones that we've seen. And this one may change the status, like I've said before.
Representative Hostica, for the department or for the presenters of the difficulty?
Well, I don't know, Mr. Chairman, who it would be for, because I'm sort of curious as to what the logic of IRAs was in the first place and why the money that's put in them is not taxable going in, and then if it's invested in government securities, not taxable coming out. I just wondered because of some other ideas, but as far as this is concerned, it's fine with me.
Jim?
Maybe I could. I think you're right on the philosophy of IRAs. The problem here is that when you're dealing with federal securities, the state cannot tax them by federal law. And so, given that that's true, given that you cannot tax the interest by federal law, all right, is it consistent with the policy of IRAs to, by the fact that you put it into the IRA, take something that was not taxable and make it taxable?
Mm-hmm.
And that is the question here, I think.
Well, part of my thinking, Mr. Chairman, was that one of the original justifications for this whole idea was to try and get people to invest in or put their money in ways that would be invested in in the economy, to try and stimulate the economy, and that was one of the justifications for making it not taxable and to encourage people to do that. Now we have people taking advantage of the non-taxable ideas and investing them instead of investing them in productive segments of the economy, putting them in government bonds. At some point, we're defeating the original purpose of the policy, but it's not anything we can affect at the state level. That's why I don't want to pursue it.
Jim Traherne?
Well, a question, Jim, I think. Under federal law, we can't tax the interest on government securities, federal securities. What's the allowable treatment on the, quote, capital gain on those same securities?
We can tax capital gain, but I think with the zero coupon bonds, in effect,
is that called
that's
interest
in effect
it's
interest, yeah, I think is the way it works.
Further questions or discussion?
Maybe you should point out the bill and how the bill stuff works. Well, I think to let you know a little bit about the process, when we started to draft some amendments, we had proposed taking House Bill 2163, which was originally one of the reconnect bills that dealt with pensions, and put this into it in place of what was in there. And having sort of made the decision to definitely go that way, last night we didn't have time to put that up this morning for a public hearing, so that's why the bill isn't here today. But that's the way the amendments are drafted, and they'd be drafted to 2163, take out the existing provisions. It is related to that bill, since the original bill had the right relating clause and it was related to pensions anyway. And so that's what we had proposed to do.
As you can imagine, the Speaker has us on a pretty short leash this time of the session. We're not supposed to be sending out or considering any additional House bills without notification. I've not notified her yet, so we'll hope it's not a problem. Anything else on the Bronner amendments in House Bill 2163? We'll revisit that issue on Monday. If not, let's open the work session on House Bill 2231. 2231 is the, let's see, who has 2231? Okay, Terry. Give us a couple of sentence review, refresher, explanation on 2231, if you would, please.
In your book, sequentially, House Bill 2231A, it makes the following changes with respect to rural fire protection districts. It allows those districts to impose a service charge in lieu of property taxes. It requires that the voters in the district approve that charge structure, and it excludes that service charge in the calculation of 30% property tax relief program. It's just an alternative to the property tax for this type of district. And it's a requirement that it be approved, the actual charge structure be approved by the voters of the district.
I had indicated to the sponsors of the bill that it was a it was a new idea and a new concept and something I thought we needed to have 31 votes on the floor of the House and 5 in the committee before we pushed a work session. And the sponsors have delivered 31 votes, have delivered a list with 32 or 33 votes, so there's actually more than 31. So that's why the measure is before us in work session this morning. Terry, are there any additional amendments that you know of?
Not that I know of.
With that, Chair moves House Bill 2231, to the floor of the House, the due pass recommendation. Discussion, Representative Trahern.
Mr. Chair, I've got a real concern with the list. In talking to some of the members, they do not understand the issue. And I wouldn't want to say they've been misled, because that's not fair to the fire folks, but I don't think the issue's been completely explained to them. And I think that there will be a lot of people that will not be near as thrilled with this issue once they understand what, in fact, they do. Now, maybe the only way to get that resolved is to take it to the floor and do that. I don't know, but I'm concerned about that.
Okay, at this point, the sponsors have shown 33 votes, and I did ask the majority and minority whips to work the floor yesterday and to reaffirm those votes, and I would conclude that there were some members that weren't fully aware of all of the implications of the measure that indicated that they were aye votes. Some indicated don't know a whole lot about it, but it sounds like a reasonable approach, something that I could vote for. That could change. But I think the best course of action for us this time is if there are 5 votes that want to send it out of committee, go ahead and send it to the floor. We have it scheduled in the Democratic caucus this morning. If the Republicans haven't talked about it yet, I assume they will after the thing is sent out. So I think we probably better just at least take the motion this morning and see what the committee wants to do.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hanlon.
If I could only remember what's the purpose of giving these potentially property taxing districts this alternative source?
The purpose for giving them the alternate source, in fact, let's ask Ted Miller to come up. You are limited to about 2 sentences, Ted, in response to that, so just get right down to your bottom line, if you would, please.
To Chair and members of the committee, Representative Hanlon, actually, it will allow us to balance where there is a tremendous imbalance in some areas of the state, large acreages under irrigation, and they are developing a fire protection need. The big thing that we see a benefit is that between the benefit and the need is that it would allow us to create monetary incentives for people to build in fire protection. In our nation, we lose more people and more property to fire than any civilized nation in the world. And we need to make some approaches of where we can create incentives for that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, did that answer your question? Further questions? Let's see, Representative Hostiger, then Representative Calori, for Ted.
I don't have a question.
Okay, Representative Calori.
I wonder if I could just ask about, on the bill, line, 14 on to 15. Other factors considered relevant by the district. What might those be?
The insurance premium benefit, the travel distance. There are some fire districts that have protection responsibilities as far as 10 miles, 15 miles away, and there needs to be a differential in that kind of a configuration.
Mm.
on this.
And those determinations are, well, actually, it says by the district board. The district board are elected, is that correct?
That is correct.
Okay. And they are, so by their very nature, they are elected because of being residents of the district. So they would be quite private citizens.
That is true.
So, and they can, so those tenants there, those relevant factors undoubtedly will vary district to district, won't they?
Yes, they will. It would, we would hope to develop a uniform guideline for all the districts in the state with the help of the assessors and other people that are involved. And then using that, each board would then develop their own criterion for placing the assessments.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Scott.
As I recall, that's the issue that killed us in the last session. And it seems to me that if, knowing that, you would have brought back the criteria.
Really?
So that we wouldn't have that same thing to wrestle with again.
Chairman, Representative Schoon, it varies with each district and each, we have almost a total different situation east of the Cascades than we have on the west side of the Cascades. So it vary. There was an attempt to work up a system like that. And as for the assessment, it would be applied as it is for, in the same format for as far as assessors are concerned as the forest land assessment protection.
But it seems to me that, Mr. Chairman, that my concern last session was that you weren't making any allowance for the distance that the fire engines had to travel to provide the service. And you recognized that was a problem, but you didn't have any way to say that this was going to be factored in or out. And the rural properties, the farm community, which seemed to think that they were going to have a lesser charge because you weren't going to have to protect their or charge them for protection of their alfalfa fields, but you had made no allowance for the distance you had to travel in order to get to their dwellings.
Chairman, soon I don't quite understand the question. However, as was pointed out, that we're seeing many of the urban areas of the state joining with the suburban and rural, and there is a difference in benefit and there is a difference in ability to serve, and those things would need to be worked into the formula.
No better off than I was 2 years ago, I think, at this point.
Ted, under the other factors, do you intend to consider the burning class of the building? In other words, would there be a different charge for a concrete building versus a wood frame one? Using, sure. Extreme.
Yes, this was what we would see because there is a whole lot different responsibility for fire protection in a concrete structure versus a structure housing what the records indicate is one of those that have frequent incidents of fire.
Who would make that determination?
It would be worked into the formula that would be adopted.
What would be the property owner's rights of appeal to that determination? Because you're going to say, you know, this guy owes $200 and this one owes $3. Now, how is he going to appeal that?
Through the normal appeals structure of government. It's a unit of government, the same as any other unit of government would have that, any individual would have that right of appeal.
Would you have these appeals then go to the Board of Equalization?
That point hadn't been addressed. I'm assuming that if it's done in other units of government, it would be done for fire districts.
Values appealed. You know, presently we're talking about value, and that's appealed to the Board of Equalization. Would you have these service charges that you've laid on an individual property owner appealed to the Board of Equalization?
I'm afraid, Representative Trevin, you're asking a question that I'm not knowledgeable enough to respond to accurately.
Thank you.
Mr.
Mr. Fugel?
I think you, without veiling your feelings too much, pointed out as this work session opened that there was not a lot of interest in the thing, but if the proponents could generate 31 votes, it would go to the floor, and the proponents have generated what appears to be more than 31. I think I would agree with Representative Trager, and let's put it on the floor and see what happens. See how many of those 31 stay there. And,
go with Chair. It.
Representative Trager.
Representative Hugo misunderstood me. I'm not sure I want to put it on the floor. I think we might ought to protect those folks themselves, but I recognize that's what you wanted to.
Mr. Chairman.
Well, I'm not sure. Frankly, there's a couple of committee members here that are listed as I votes that have indicated that they had never committed. So maybe the best thing to do is for us to see if there's a motion. And if there is a motion, work with that motion.
Mr. Chairman, just so people aren't misled, I had told the proponents when they asked me that I would be in favor of this bill if it applied to all property as it was originally drafted and not all taxable property. So if the committee wants to consider amending the bill back to its original version, then I would be happy to vote it out. But that was a position that I stated when they asked me.
Mr. Chairman. Tim Scott. I think Gary Carlson and a couple of very significant points that he just mentioned to me, one that I was completely unaware of, and that's that payments, the fees that would be paid for this fire support are not deductible as taxes are, for example. And so I would like to, if we could, have him come up and explain those two concerns. There may be some other things that we aren't aware of.
Gary Carlson, would you come up, please? You had a couple of concerns in relation to 2231. Could you do one sentence on each, please?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Gary Carlson, for the record, Associated Oregon Industries. I think our primary concern with this bill is in subsection 3 of section 2, which has been discussed here briefly, and that is the rather broad scope of criteria which may be used to develop a scheme for service charges rather than an ad valorem tax. Obviously, many of our members that we represent are in unincorporated areas of the state. The state is basically has fairly confined city boundaries. Outside of city boundaries, fire protection districts provide the fire service. Our concern and fear is that with this mechanism, at some place and in some time, it's perhaps likely that a board will devise an assessment, a fee-based system, and submit it to the voters, which would entail a substantial shift of burden based on those criteria put together, whether it's square footage or some other basis, which would result in a lower burden for residential property and a higher burden for other property. Our concern is that the voters might see that to their advantage with some different motive, I guess, being put forward by the board. That's our primary concern. If it were substantially tighter, we might be a little less concerned about it.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman.
Representative Scone?
I would hope that we would not act on this today and defer at least until Monday, so that I would like to go talk to some of the proponents in the Republican caucus that have been going around with the list soliciting votes and mention a couple of these things to them to ask whether or not they are aware of these.
Okay. That's a request that I think it's appropriate that we comply with. I get the reading of the tea leaves that's a sense of the committee. Might it be appropriate for us to put a couple of people together from the committee to work with the proponents or with some of the concerns that were recently raised? How does the committee want to proceed? I think
I'd be glad to be one of those persons. Mr.
Okay. Representative Schoon, should we have Representative Schoon, or should we appoint him as a working group of one to work with the proponents of the bill inside and outside and report back to us on Monday? Do you want to do that, John?
Yes, I'll do that.
Okay. Anything further to come before us? Jim Clory?
I don't know if there's a need for a second person, but if you need somebody to kind of split the work up with, and I happen to have a district that doesn't even know what a rural file district is. So,
okay, Representative Clory will work.
Don't want to muddle it up, but if there's any need to kind of spread the work out or contact people or something, I'll be glad to do that.
That's fine. Representative Clory then will work with Representative Scone. The next item on our agenda this morning is House Bill 2382. Representative Schoon, would you please take the lead on that this morning?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, after yesterday's meeting, I met with Representative Cooley's constituent, frankly, out in the hall afterwards, and we talked about the issue, and he agreed that if we would simply let the values established by the Board of Equalization stand until either the regular reappraisal cycle or a physical reappraisal was done, that would be adequate. It would serve his intent, which is not to have that automatic increase simply at the stroke of the assessor's pen the subsequent year. One other thing that needs to be considered is that with a regular reappraisal cycle of 5 years, the average time for this value to be in effect would be 2.5 years. If it was on a 6-year basis, it would be in effect for 3 years on average. And if the assessor is really concerned that there is an